Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to 2020 Politics War Room with James Carville, who's out in the Shenandoah, and I'm Al Hunt here in Washington. We are proud partners with the Sign Institute at American University in Washington, and someday we hope to get back to that studio. We have a couple great guests this week, but I want to first thank you all who have been writing your opinions and questions on email. I hope we get to answer most of them. We love that you're interacting with us. Remember to tell your friends about the show, and please subscribe, rate, and review Politics War Room on Apple Podcast. Now to our guest, Jeff Garron. There's a small group of American pollsters that are reliably accurate and always honest. A number were trained by Peter Hart, Ann Selzer, Fred Yang, and our guest today, Jeff Garron, the president of Hart Research, pollster for two of the most important Democratic support groups, Priorities USA and the Senate Majority PAC, as well as most every prominent Democratic top office holder. Jeff, first, thank you for being with us. I know you're stuck up in Martha's Vineyard, but I hope you're getting a good sense of the pulse of the people up there.
Well, we know what the Martha Vineyarders think.
Every time that you talk to most Democrats these days, and anyone exudes confidence about this November, they will say, ooh, and they'll hearken back to 2016. Let's not forget what happened back then. What are the differences and any similarities between Joe Biden standing today as opposed to Hillary Clinton on August 6, 2016?
Well, you know, I think inaccurately, but, you know, 4 years ago at this point, Hillary Clinton's was not a trusted figure at all among Americans. People focused back then on the fact that close to 60% of voters thought that that Donald Trump didn't have the temperament to be president, but really didn't pay very much attention to the reality that nearly as many people thought that Hillary Clinton didn't have the honesty and integrity to be president. Again, I think it's definitely a misperception of her, but the level of antagonism to Hillary Clinton 4 years ago does not compare at all to voters' attitudes to Joe Biden today. So that's a really big difference. And we're not talking about small numbers. We're talking about large numbers in this regard. Some polls show that in his personal favorabilities, Biden is slightly below water, but not all polls show that, but certainly not by the margin that Secretary Clinton was, and more importantly, not with the intensity that people felt about Hillary Clinton.
So his standing today is considerably stronger, you would say, than hers 4 years ago?
Yes. I think there's just in terms of kind of the how they view the two of them. But I think Donald Trump is a different person today in the voters' minds than he was 4 years ago. That 4 years ago at this point, Trump had high negatives, as he does now. People didn't like the way he comported itself and his demeanor and things of that sort. But, you know, if you wanted to be for Donald Trump back then, you could say to yourself, you know, this is an act that, the office makes the man. If Donald Trump gets elected president, he'll put the shtick aside and start to act in a kind of a presidential way. Now, especially in the wake of the COVID crisis, nobody is under the illusion anymore that you know, this is not the real Donald Trump. People know who he is, who he is, and will never be anything different. So, you know, there's no, you can't resolve your dissonance by saying, oh, well, you know, when he gets into office, he's going to change. People know that this guy doesn't change, that that he, you know, he has zero learning curve. And so that, you know, that that people really are reckoning with the reality of Donald Trump in a way that they weren't 4 years ago.
Let me pick up on a variation that I try to absorb every poll that's out there, particularly if it has Jeff Garin or Hart attached to it. But I also look at a couple other things that I think in some ways are as telling. 4 years ago, I think, and this picks up on your point, there were 1 in 7 voters that didn't like Trump or Clinton. And according to Gallup on election day, 69-31, they went for Trump. Now, if you think about it, that's logical. You know, they're both bums, but why not go, you know, for the new one? There are similar surveys today that show there's a number of voters that don't like either one of these candidates, but they, by an overwhelming majority, prefer Biden. Again, logical. I can't take 4 more years of this guy. And I guess the second thing that strikes me is that I can't find, just in phone calls, you don't go out now, anyone who last time voted for Hillary who this time say they're going to vote for Trump. And she did win the popular vote last time. I'm just struck by both of those. Is that too micro?
No, not – well, you know, arithmetic matters. On the first point, you're exactly right about just the statistical reality of people who don't like either candidate this time. It's the devil they know who they worry much more about. And people think, you know, we're at a high point now. Al, we've been working together for years and decades, so you know what the right track, wrong track numbers have been over time. We're at a high point now where people are saying the country is going in the wrong direction. So there's this impetus for change, for one thing. But, you know, just in terms of the basic arithmetic of the election, here's the deal, as Joe Biden would say, you are right that there are very few people who voted for Hillary Clinton who have somehow said, oh, I made a mistake and now I want to be for Donald Trump. The numbers are negligible in the kind of, you know, very low single digits. There are, you know, it's not most people who voted for Donald Trump, a large majority of people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 will vote for him again in 2020. But the fraction who will not is larger than the people who will defect, the Clinton voters who will defect to Trump the other way. Then you've got kind of the third party voters from 2016. And they are now much more inclined to choose between the two party candidates, and they are overwhelmingly inclined toward Biden. And then the biggest piece of the puzzle and the most important segment of voters by my lights are the people who did not vote in 2016 at all, either because they were too young or because they chose not to vote. I would guess that, you know, we're looking at somewhere between, you know, around 15% of the 2020 electorate will be people who didn't vote in 2016. And in every poll that we've done, that group of voters is now splitting very decisively for Joe Biden, led by young voters splitting in an overwhelmingly large degree for Vice President Biden.
Well, let's turn to James Carville, but I do want to point out, because you noted it, that for 16 years, when I was at the Wall Street Journal, I directed a poll with Jeff Garin and Peter Hart and the late, great Bob Teeter. It's one of the reasons I have such enormous respect for Jeff Garin. James, take over.
Thank you. So, Jeff, as I count, we've been knowing each other for 40 years, which translates into 10 presidential cycles. You've probably seen more polls than anybody in this business. What 3 or 4 things stand out about August the 6th in a presidential year this year that is unique among presidential elections that you have seen?
Yes, yes, yes. It's a good question because, you know, there are, you know, part of the reason why after 40 years, more than 40 years, I still wake up every day really excited to go to work and really interested in what I'm doing is kind of things change a lot. And so there's a lot about this election and the way it's conducted that that's unique. I'm not sure that's relates to a particular number in a poll. But before I talk about that, you know, people keep on hearkening back to the 2016 election, and Democrats, still are, have PTSD about that election. But, to me, I think that we're kind of more analogous to the 2008 election, not because people are excited about Biden in the same way they were about Obama, but because, you know, in the wake of the financial crisis, people really kind of made a decision that we, you know, needed to make a change in the country. And, where we are now with the coronavirus crisis is very much like where people were on the financial crisis. In fact, I would say that the situation today with the coronavirus crisis is worse for President Trump and the Republicans than the financial crisis was for President Bush, Senator McCain, and the Republicans back then, because they see Trump as being so negligent and responsible for how bad this has become for the country. That's the other kind of, very big difference from 2016 is that the election was not being conducted against the backdrop of this profound crisis that most Americans really think of as a profound crisis. And most Americans say the worst of the crisis is still ahead of us, not behind us, because of Trump's failure to deal appropriately and aggressively with it. As we talk about, looking at elections over time, over that 40-year period, this is kind of a lot more like Jimmy Carter and the hostage crisis in 1980, or the Republican Party and the financial crisis in 2008, than it is in any which way compared to 2016. I think, James, in terms of your other question about what's unique about this election is and the data is, it's really the continuation of a trend. It's just how siloed people are in terms of, what information they're getting and who they're getting it from. When you and I started, there's a kind of a real such thing as a national debate that Americans were exposed to. And, we're not seeing that very much at all. This is kind of people are kind of hearing about the election and hearing about the candidates based on their kind of what compartment they're in.
So one of the numbers I always look for in a poll is a self-identified ID. And since Trump has been elected, it strikes me that, 2018 was a Republican disaster of epic proportions, both in terms of turnout, popular vote. I was disappointed in Florida and Ohio, but they had literally 90% of the off-year elections, Democrats have performed way above expected performance. Have you seen a decline in Republican identifiers during the Trump years?
Well, we've seen that on steroids in the last 6 weeks, where, one, not to get too nerdy on you here, but one of the things.
No, we're doing a nerdy kind of semi-nerdy show.
We love nerds.
So one of the things that's, changed is that over the way we do polling over time is that we now work exclusively from voter files, where there are kind of modeled scores that predict whether somebody's a Democrat or a Republican. And so that when we do a survey, we make sure, kind of in a very rigid way, that our sample of completed interviews is reflective of the distribution of those predictions. Doesn't mean the predictions are right, but it means our sample is consistent with what we would expect based on the voter file. So even, you know, with that control for predicted party, we're seeing a kind of a very substantial decline in people identifying with the Republican Party. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you just think of what's going on today, you know, right now, where we have in the middle of this crisis, Congress has to determine what kind of measure to pass in the next COVID bill. And the Republicans in the Senate are now wholly irrelevant to that, to this process. You know, because there are 14 to 20 Republican senators who would never vote for anything, McConnell has no, and the Republican Party is so divided, McConnell really had, there's no there any longer for the Republican Party. So this is entirely a Speaker Pelosi, Leader Schumer negotiation with the White House. And you know, the Republican Party, I think, has really not just lost its way, but lost its meaning for voters. And, you know, it's become kind of a, you know, this kind of native, well, it's become the party of Trump more than anything else. And the fact that it's the party of Trump, as you know, support for him declines, support for the Republican Party declines with it.
Right. The, you know, when people say, oh, James, 90% of the Republicans back Trump. And I said, look, if 90% of 41 is a hell of a lot different than 90% of 35. I mean, you can't. So what happens is, as they lose, as people go from being weak Republican to independent or independent to weak Democrat, the face of the electorate changes. And it's less, and of course, the smaller your self-ID number is, the more your base or the more hardcore people are the left. And this is not an evenly divided country at all. There are just more people that don't like Republicans than do like Republicans. And it's not very close. And that's just one of the things that drives me crazy when people just say, well, we're evenly divided as a country. We're not.
We definitely are not. You know, and it's not just, you know, party identification. One question that we asked with Al way back when, at NBC Wall Street Journal poll, and continue to ask is, do you want government to be doing more or less? And the Republicans have always been the party of less, leaving more things up to businesses and individuals. And we are now very decidedly in a country of wanting government to do more, to be more active in solving problems facing the country today. So it's not just the kind of the party identifications, but it's also what the party represents. And James, just in terms of, you know, thinking about the arithmetic of what you were saying, you could think of, well, you know, what's happened is you had somebody who identified as a kind of Republican a year ago, who now, when you ask them, say, I'm an independent. But you might think that, you know, because that's a former Republican, they're still conservative and still more inclined to vote for Democratic candidates, even though we have kind of a different composition of the independent vote than we had previously. The independent vote right now is still far more pro-Biden than it was pro-Clinton in 2016.
Jeffrey, let me, when you talk about those Democratic, I think false, as you have pointed out, nightmares about the 2016 analogy, Secretary Clinton, of course, won that popular vote. So it's the Electoral College that throws people in some kind of a tizzy. I think, first of all, I think that was an aberration last time. Some of it, frankly, due to the Clinton campaign's miscalculations. But let's just go through a couple of the important subsets and see how they stand today. First of all, there's the blue wall, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, that cracked 4 years ago and cost the Democrats the election. How do those states look today?
Trump is substantially behind in all of them. I mean, the you know, there's some variation in the some of the public polls that are and that has to do with the polls themselves as opposed to the reality on the ground. But you know, in terms of the work that we're doing in our internal private polling and what you see in the public polls, Biden has had a solid, stable lead in all three states. You know, Michigan and Pennsylvania are kind of, I think, are, you know, becoming more solidly for Biden. Wisconsin, which is, you would have thought, would have been the kind of most tenuous of the three, also has been, you know, not by kind of huge numbers, but consistently advantage to Biden. So kind of on those three states, which President Trump won by a collective 77,000 votes in 2016, it's hard to see, you know, that 77,000 votes, you know, carrying him through to victory across those three states this time.
That would be game, set, match. Let me turn to the changing South, Sun Belt, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, Arizona.
Well, I don't think they're all in the same category, but the fact that I think Arizona is a little bit better than the others in terms of the possibility or probability of Biden carrying them. Biden is ahead in North Carolina, but North Carolina will be competitive. And, you know, the fact that we're talking about Georgia and Texas as competitive states just speaks volumes. And you know, those are, you know, very close races. And, you know, I think campaigns are, you know, Vice President Biden is, his campaign's decided to invest in those states. I think there's good reason to think that they're winnable, but they're, you know, the fact that they're even competitive now, I think, is kind of reflective of what terrible shape the Republican Party is in, and but also the changing nature of the electorate in those states. You know, Texas is you know, a place where the weakness of Republicans among suburban voters is really coming to haunt them now. And remember, you know, the other big thing about Texas is how hard it's been hit by the coronavirus crisis. Where they now feel in a very personal way that you know, that their state has been a victim of the too little too late approach of President Trump, the kind of the urging people to reopen the economy even when it wasn't safe to do that. So a state's experience with COVID is important. A colleague of mine named Jesse Steinbring, who's a really smart young analyst, kind of emailed me yesterday about the correlation between a state's experience with COVID and the strength or weakness of President Trump. And as more states are having more serious COVID experiences, it's taking a toll on President Trump and other Republicans.
Well, Jeff, I mean, I think James has got a lot to pick up on this. But just finally, those states that we thought were irredeemably red, Ohio and Missouri, is Biden the ideal candidate in those two places?
I think he is. I mean, relative to President Trump, I think the comparison is good. That I think there's a comfort level with Biden among suburban voters who are, you know, Missouri yesterday passed an expansion of Medicaid, driven by votes around the Kansas City metropolitan area and the St. Louis metropolitan area, and then sort of some, you know, competitive results in other parts of the state. And so I think Joe Biden is able to both kind of maximize support in those kind of metro areas, and you know, while still being relatable to many kind of working class voters too.
I was like a sleeper. You know, my sleeper this cycle, I actually got two: Alaska Senate and Missouri Governor. That, you know, races that just don't pop right into people's minds right away. You got a couple of sleepers out there that might not be, you know, on the national headlines, but Democratic candidates that you think are going to do better than people anticipate.
Well, I definitely, I think those two are really smart, choices. I think, you know, even if Trump wins Georgia narrowly, I think John Ossoff is going to give David Perdue a hell of a good race in Georgia. You know, if there's a real wave, I'm not predicting that there will be, but I certainly think that that is a possibility. You know, we're going to, I think we're going to, you know, see some upsets. You know, one, this is not an individual race, but here's kind of a sleeper prediction, that I think there's a decent chance that, that the Democrats will expand their majority in the House as opposed to have their majority be contracted, which is something that nobody thought possible at the beginning of this cycle. I'm not certain that that's going to happen, but it's a lot more likely now that that could happen than it was 6 months ago or a year ago. And, you know, people were, I think some people were fretting about, you know, and the Republicans were threatening, you know, about what the impact of impeachment would be on House Democrats. You know, the short answer to that is zero. Zero negative impact. I think some positive impact. But there are some Republicans, Democrats running in kind of Trump districts that will be hard pressed. Things that were narrowly Trump districts in 2016, I think Democrats are going to do really well in those House races, and even in the ones that were larger Trump victories in 2016, where it's now represented by a Democrat, I think most of those Democrats will also win. So, despite the imbalance in seats, the Republicans are having more retirements in the House. So, I think Democrats have a good chance of winning the Senate, and they have a good chance of expanding their majority in the House, which is, I think, kind of an extraordinary state of affairs.
Thank you. Albert?
Well, I was going to say, I just have gone over the House races with some experts, Jeff. There are, by a margin of a half dozen or more Republican-held seats in play today than there are Democratic seats in play. I mean, that really is kind of stunning. You don't expect that when a party has a majority. There are, I would guess, well over a dozen Republican seats in play. And there are, you know, maybe five or six Democratic-held seats. That's it. They're places they thought they were really in good, you know, they were going to come and they're going to win back. Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey and Jason Crow out in Colorado and Lucy McBath down in Georgia, where they're not even very competitive. It's just stunning. Let me ask you this. This has been a very upbeat assessment of where Democrats, where Joe Biden stands. What keeps you awake at night? What worries you? If the Biden people were to say, okay, in these next, whatever it is now, 13 weeks, what do you think they're going to do? How they're going to come after us? Where might we be vulnerable? What should we be prepared for?
Well, I mean, there are things that we're looking at in our research. You know, we have some evidence of a substantial economic recovery between now and the election. We're trying to understand what the impact of that will be. I don't think that that's going to happen at this stage. And one of the really interesting results and important results we've found in that regard is that, you know, we ask people to imagine a scenario where President Trump has been able to lower the unemployment rate in the United States from, you know, a high of 19.3% down to 8 or 9% in October. So, you know, evidence of substantial progress there. But also imagine at the same time the number of fatalities. We asked this not so long ago when it was about 120,000 fatalities. Now we're already well above 150,000 fatalities. But at the same time that the unemployment rate is going down to 8 or 9%, that the number of deaths has increased to 200,000 people. And, you know, how would they feel in that circumstance? And by close to 2 to 1, people said, that's not a good bargain for America. I would think of that as a failure rather than a success if we get unemployment that low, but the fatalities are that high. But still, we're trying to understand the impact of a recovering economy. If that indeed occurs, we're trying to understand the impact of, you know, if President Trump is able to make some dramatic announcement of kind of a vaccine, you know, how will people react to that? So, you know, I think this is, it's not structural questions that worry me so much. It's not, you know, is the Trump campaign all of a sudden going to hit on a really smart strategy? That doesn't worry me so much, although, you know, I think they're, you know, I don't, you know, take that for granted, that they won't, but, the problem is they've got Trump. You know, it's really about events. I think it will take events for things to change the election. And so as opposed to something about the structure of the race or some tactical or strategic decision that one campaign or the other makes.
So, yeah, my advice to any of your clients is this. It's time for a change. You know, 80% wrong track country. Change is the greatest word in the English language for an out party in a 3-to-1 wrong track country.
Well, I think you're right.
That's my view.
I think you're right. And, you know, I also think that, you know, we've had change, you know, it's people thought in 2016, it was a time for change. And part of the reason why Donald Trump got elected back then, now they kind of feel that even more powerfully. So you're definitely right about that. And for, you know, Democrats obviously have to kind of represent the, you know, that change. But I think, you know, the extension of that, James, is not just that we need a change, but that in every way imaginable, President Trump and the Republicans are changing things for the worse. They're making things worse than they needed to be or had to be. And it's not just on COVID, but on that for sure that on COVID, President Trump is making things worse. On the economic impacts of the COVID crisis, he's making things worse. In terms of people's access to affordable health care that they can rely on, he's making things worse. In terms of the unity of the country and what's going on with protests, he's making things worse. So it's not just that we need a change and the Democrats need to represent that. But in 2020, there's a very specific case, is that on the things that are most important to America and Americans right now, Donald Trump and the Republican Party are consistently making things worse. And that we need to elect Democrats to turn that around and turn the country around.
The one thing we know is Jeff Garin is consistently good. Jeff, Peter Hart trained you well. We can't thank you enough for being with us. Please give our best to Debbie and stay safe up there in the People's Republic of Martha's Vineyard.
I will do. Thank you for having me.
The Riches of the Land, Jim Tankersley's book, with compelling personal stories and convincing data about how America built a robust middle class in the generation after World War II, with not just white workers, but also people of color, and then, sadly, how it has eroded. Jim is the chief economics writer for the New York Times and has covered politics and economic policies for more than a decade and a half. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You write that politicians, but particularly Donald Trump, have conned the middle class, some playing to racial and cultural divisions, while workers are falling further and further behind, sometimes working two or three jobs, not just to get even further behind.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. The decline of the American middle class, even before this pandemic recession, which turns out to have been the second once-in-a-lifetime recession of my lifetime thus far. Even before then, the middle class was stagnating. It was not enjoying anywhere close to the gains that it had made in the late 1990s or particular in the period after World War II. And I think the con that populist politicians have pulled on American workers is this idea that the only way to get back is by cracking down on immigrants, by cracking down on trade, through sort of a set of policies that are designed to, in one way or the other, restrict certain groups of people from contributing to the economy. And my argument is the opposite, that history shows us the reason we had a vibrant middle-class boom after World War II was because all workers really got ahead, not just white men, but in particular women and men of color had been shut out of the great opportunities of the U.S. economy for centuries. And after World War II, they began to demand entry into much better jobs. And when they got those better jobs and contributed their talents to the economy, the entire economy boomed. And that was why we had such a great period for the middle class. And really, with the exception of the late 90s, why we haven't had one since. And so I think that the real recipe is to re-empower those workers, women and men of color and immigrants, and then everyone will get ahead, including white men. And that's not the story you hear so often from populist politicians today.
Jim, let me ask you, because Donald Trump, pre-pandemic, claimed no one has done as much for African Americans. They were doing better economically and wage-wise than any time in history. What are the facts?
Well, the facts are that Donald Trump inherited an economy that had been finally starting to work for everyone. And what we know, Al, about black workers in American history is they tend to be hurt first by recessions and recover last. It's just the sad truth of discrimination in our economy. And we had a long road to recovery from the Great Recession. We were finally getting to a place where it was really starting to deliver for black workers. And, in the final years of Barack Obama's presidency, the black unemployment rate was falling faster than it actually did under Trump. But, it's the old expression, born on third base, think you hit a triple. Trump comes into office with a 4.7% unemployment rate and a real couple of year set of momentum on improvements for workers that come with a tighter labor market toward the end of an economic cycle. And so he's claimed credit for the levels basically that the economy reached when he came in. When if you just look at rates of change, how fast the economy grew, how fast incomes were going up for most people, his economy is basically indistinguishable from the second term of Obama or even the second term of George W. Bush. So his great achievement economically has been selling Americans on the idea that what he did was special as opposed to the conditions he inherited were special.
How much? Let me go again to this overarching point about the decline. How much of it, middle class decline, how much of it is attributable to the decline of labor unions? Labor unions back in the 50s were about 35% of the workforce. I think it's less than 15 now. How much of it is due to the decline of labor unions?
I think that it's certainly a real part of the story. I mean, labor unions, of course, have had an interesting role in American history. At times, they have been exclusionary forces. You know, they excluded certain workers and kept them from getting good jobs. But at other times, they've been major forces for inclusion and forces for bargaining power. And I think that is, bargaining power is clearly something American workers have not had for in very long supply for decades. And again, it only at the times of really low unemployment, when you have a low unionization rate, it's only when the labor market's really tight that workers can demand raises to the degree that, you know, they had in the past. And so, you know, what we had in the late 90s was a scenario where the economy was growing really fast with really low unemployment, which I think is sort of the recipe for broadly shared prosperity. And so it didn't matter as much. But then when you have higher unemployment or slower growth, workers who do not have bargaining power definitely found that they were not able to get wage gains while corporate profits were rising.
So, Jim, I've written, first of all, congratulations on a book, and weaving these narratives is really an interesting thing. But the first thing when I see one of these books, I do is I go to the last chapter where you talk about solutions. And you actually did a much better job than most. I mean, you honestly called around, you got ideas. What ideas that stick out in your mind of things that we could do to help reverse this, what's obviously happening to a vast number of Americans and have been happening to them for quite a while?
Well, so I think there's basically two buckets of things. One is sort of things policymakers can do right now. And it's just such a great question. You know, I think women are such a key to our economy. They are they're statistically our highest skilled, best educated workers right now in the country. And yet they are still struggling to participate in the labor force to the degree that they used to. So I think a big suite of policies to remove the impediments women have to working and getting ahead, and that starts with childcare. There's just so much that sort of our social norms hold women back because, and we see it in the pandemic right now, there are millions of women who are unable to work at all or work as much as they want because they are being forced to care for children at home with school not being open. And we don't have a good public policy solution for that, even in regular times, let alone in the pandemic. So I think it starts there. I think, you know, I propose a few kind of radical things in there. I think our elite universities should have to admit far more students, Stanford's and Harvard's and Yale's of the world, and they should be really focusing on low income, students from low opportunity areas, from disadvantaged backgrounds, and so we can be just, you know, really churning out more high quality graduates. But James, I think actually the other thing, which is much harder, that we need is almost like a national attitudinal shift. We need to agree, all of us, that we don't want workers fighting with each other anymore, and that racism and sexism aren't just bad for women or for men of color. They're bad for everyone. And if we could get this sort of national agreement that, hey, we're really going to try to complete the work of civil rights, which was left unfinished, I actually think that would be the greatest economic policy we could have. And that's not something you can pass through a law. That's something we all kind of have to decide on a community and individual level, and we need real leadership for.
So I entered the workforce late. I was 29, 1973. I just graduated from law school. There was one African-American in my class and three women. I didn't know what a BMW or Sony TV was. Germany and Japan were still digging out. China was being led by a madman, right? That's not the world that someone, that's not the workforce that someone is entering today. And I know I had a law degree, but just take it in general. I mean, the world is just a much, much more competitive place. And I don't, you know, of course I'm for more unions. I think Warren's federal daycare is the single best proposal maybe to come out of 2020 cycle. But there is a, we just don't live in the same world when we had these growing wages and we had, you know, 6-7% GDP growth. And I don't think that's going to come back.
So I mean, I agree. It's a totally different world. And I think part of what's happened is that those changes have advantaged, you know, particular sets of workers who kind of control the institutions, the business world. I mean, CEOs remain predominantly white men from elite universities. You know, the finance industry remains dominated by white men. So the changes in the economy that have helped corporate America and multinational companies and have helped Wall Street have disproportionately helped those workers. You know, I think about this a lot. I lay out in the book. I got interested in middle class questions, you know, when I was a kid, long before I entered the workforce, because I grew up in a timber town in Western Oregon, where the guys I went to high school with, so many of them, you know, their dads worked in or around the timber industry, and those jobs, when they cratered in the 80s and 90s, just weren't going to be available to the guys I went to school with. And I wanted to know, you know, when is this changing world going to start working for those guys? And it's, of course, it's not just those guys. It's black men and you know, women from rural areas across the country and cities and suburbs. But it the question of when will this new economy create good-paying jobs for those workers is sort of consumed me in my entire time as an economics reporter. And I've just really come to this conclusion that they really have the potential to contribute. It is a more competitive world. It is one that advantages people with higher education. But I truly believe there is potential in the American workforce that is untapped, that if we just get the right entrepreneurs creating companies that use, you know, human labor in new and interesting ways, that good jobs can reappear. We just haven't found those combinations yet.
So you did mention, and I just twice, so I want to point it out for a third time, that we did have across the board income growth in the late 90s, which is probably the apex of what's happened in this country since the early 70s. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely.
And who was president in the late 90s?
That was the Bill Clinton presidency. I think you may remember that.
It is verboten to say anything good about the Clinton presidency. I just wanted to point that out.
No, I think, you know, I have a stat in the book that I had to check like six times because I barely believed it, James. But if we had continued through this century, since 2000, with the income growth that we had in the second term of the Clinton presidency, the median American family, the American middle class today, would be earning 50% more than it's earning now. I mean, it's just a dramatic drop off that we've had since the end of the Clinton presidency.
Thank you, Justice Scalia.
Well, I think, you know, we also had a bursting tech bubble, and then you know, the China shock really did that started that, you know, to be fair, was ushered in part by Clinton policies, did take away a lot of good jobs in America.
It did. That's fair, and it came back. Obama had TPP. And that would have helped a lot, but of course we didn't do that. But we were in pretty good shape in 2000.
We were. No, we were in great shape.
You know, the other thing, I mean, your book is just fascinating in the way it chronicles this all. You know, everything that's happened, Jim, but it also has some wonderful personal portraits. Tell us about Ed Green.
Oh, man. You know, I feel like, you know, you're a reporter and my favorite stories are always the stories where I get to just get out in the world and talk to folks who are working in their jobs about how the economy affects them. And I've met a lot of wonderful people in my career, but I've probably never met anyone as extraordinary as Ed. He's a guy from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I met him in the fall of 2013, on the last day of the minor league baseball season in Winston-Salem. And he came ambling down the concourse, a very tall black man, shook my hand. He was basically like, I think, the 12th or the 13th hour of his workday. He got up every morning, laid tar on the highway for the state, and then he worked a second job every night doing custodial service in the summer for the baseball team, in the winter for Wake Forest football and basketball. And he is just a soft-spoken, thoughtful, very kind man who works his butt off every day, still does, and does it because he wants to give his family the sort of middle-class life that you used to be able to get with one job. And Ed has to do it with two jobs, or now he's down to a job and a half. He's ramped down just a little bit, but
and sometimes it's been three.
Sometimes three. Yep. And so I wrote about him the following year, and then I just stayed in touch with him, and I got to meet his family and tell their story. And I went back down last summer to talk to him, and And we talked about how hard it is to work in all those jobs and what it does to you. And he never complains. You know, he got cancer and never missed a day of work, even with treatment. Just an extraordinary example of the spirit of the American worker. And yet the economy is still not working for him. And he's worried that it's not working for his kids, who he worked hard to send to college. And his kids are just wonderful, you know, adults now. And, you know, I just feel really lucky to have had the chance to tell his story. And it's sort of the backbone of the book. His family, his parents embody the great middle class surge of the post-war era. And then his own story embodies kind of the downfall of the middle class since then.
Well, there are many reasons to read this book, but I want everyone who does to really, really look. I mean, read about Ed Green. He's a remarkable guy. Did he get his college degree while he was working these two and three jobs?
He has not yet. It's his goal for when he's done. He wants to go back and not just get a college degree. James, he wants to get a law degree. When it's all over, he wants to basically help. He wants to do sort of labor law and help workers like himself, you know, navigate the difficulties of the workforce now.
You know, the sad thing is the law degree is really expensive now. My tuition was $110 a semester. I'd work offshore and had like $5,000 in my pocket, and I was on a GI Bill. I got $300 a month. I was in the early 70s. I was so flush, it was unbelievable. But now these kids graduated from law school and they got $150,000 worth of debt. I mean, it's really tough.
No, we've made it really hard for young people to get the education they need to even just compete for the you know, medium paying jobs anymore. I mean, that's just a sad fact of our economy.
Well, I know a little bit about a certain university in Winston-Salem, and I'm going to strongly recommend that they contact Mr. Green, because he'd be a great asset, whatever he can do for them. But boy, it's an incredible story, Jim.
Well, thank you guys so much for letting me ramble on about it. I feel very passionately about the people in the book and about the themes. And I think, we're in a moment in America where we're rebuilding the economy again. And we do have some choices to make. And if we choose to invest in each other and not just, snipe at each other, well, maybe we got a shot. Maybe we could do this.
Well, as James asked you, you spell out some of the things we can do in taking advantage of that shot. And I would encourage all of our listeners to read The Riches of the Land by Jim Tankersley, who is as good an economics reporter as there is in Washington today. Now that my buddy Dave Wessel has left, Jim, I may even crown you as the best. But it's a terrific book, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Good luck to you, Jim. It's a great book. Great effort. You should be very proud of it.
Thank you, James. Thank you so much.
Well, boy, that was, that was a good show, James.
It really was. You know, I want to talk about something, and Jim, people allude to this, about these massive endowments that these schools have. Harvard, Stanford, MIT, you pick it, right? And one of the ideas is that they expand enrollment. Okay, so let's just say 1,000 more come in. What I think they should do is get together and use the endowment their expertise to make some of these community colleges better. I mean, you can educate masses of people at Dade County, or Northern Virginia Community College, or King's Community College in Seattle. And I think there's more bang for the buck improving that level of education than just churning out more elite school graduates. I mean, I really think there's more bang for the whole economy.
Amen. You know, I mentioned Dave Wessel a minute ago. 20 years ago, he and Bob Davis wrote a book about community colleges as the engine of economic growth in America in the early part of the 21st century. It was right on. And James, one of the tragedies, and this has been done largely at the state level, but the feds bear some responsibility, we have cut back on assistance to community colleges.
Yeah.
And that is a terribly dumb short-term decision. They are great investments.
Yeah, I'd like to see some of these big endowment schools say, hey, we're going to help, and we're going to, we're going to assign faculty. We're going to look at your programs. You know, if there's electrician training program at Dade County, or maybe an MIT, you know, electrical engineer can take a look at it and say, hey, these are 10 things you can do and whatever, boom, boom, boom.
I mean, the healthcare industry in America, which is so under-resourced right now, basically depends on community colleges for their workforce. You cannot be an auto mechanic today unless you have at least a level 14 education, which is community college. So you're right. That is a...
I'd love to see a bigger focus on that. But what a show.
It was a great show. Before we go, our erstwhile producer, Jeremiah, said, just tell people... just briefly at the end, what you're watching, what you're reading. James, I'm watching baseball. I'm watching the Washington Nationals because I've missed it so much. And when the game, it may not matter. They're only 4-4. I'm not at all confident the season will continue. But when it comes on, I say, Hosanna, here it is. And I usually watch it until the end of the ninth inning. Last night it was the seventh because of rain. And reading, I did a lot of work reading. I wanted to read Jim's book this week. I read your colleague Paul Begala's book because I'm doing something with him. I read the Mary Trump book because someone said you ought to read it. It was okay. And my favorite book of this week is Christopher Buckley's Make Russia Great Again, the novel about Donald Trump. I guarantee if anyone reads it, you will laugh for 2 solid hours. So tell us what you've been doing.
Well, I'm reading Burning the House Down. Be discussing that about the Gingrich Revolution, and it was crazier than I remember. And for fiction, my friend Daniel Silva and I'm a big Daniel Silva guy, has a new book called The Order, which is as much fun as I've had reading a piece of fiction in a long time, put it that way. And it's fiction, but it's very educational and very thought-provoking, as everything that Dan Silva writes is. Now, I'm a big fan of his, and I'm really a big fan of his newest book.
Oh, he's a really, really talented writer. And, you know, as is Chris Buckley, he's got a character, and you can guess who this is, James. It's the senior senator from South Carolina who once was a harsh Trump critic who's turned into a sycophant, and his name is Squiggly Lee Biscuit. Now, I don't know who that could be, but I'll tell you, this really was. I love this show. I love those two guests. I learned a lot. That's what we're all about. I just want to thank everybody out there for listening to 2020 Politics War Room. I hope you'll follow the show on Twitter at Politics War Room. I hope James's dog will follow the show. Yeah. I hope you'll email us at politicswarroom@gmail.com. That's politicswarroom@gmail.com. Thank you for subscribing. Please rate the show, hopefully with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week. We've got another good guest right on the eve of the Democratic Convention, such as it is. So everybody be safe out there. James, you be safe out there.
I got a new slogan for the show. We got bark.
All right, he's going to be our special guest most weeks, okay?
All right.
All right, thank you and be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.